Today on Against the Grain. Open any world history book and you'll read that the Neolithic Revolution was the key turning point in human history, when hunter-gatherers gave up roaming in small egalitarian tribes and settled down to farm. Out of that, civilization was born, with all the benefits and ills connected to it. The rise of cities, the emergence of the state, inequality, and class society. But according to anthropologist David Graeber, that tale is not based on fact. I'm Sasha Lilly. David Graeber joins me to interrogate this chronicle of Paradise Lost and much more. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. How do the ways that we think about the past limit our visions of the future? In particular, how does our understanding of inequality in human society shape our sense of whether we can radically change our deeply unequal society today? I recently put those questions to anarchist anthropologist David Graeber, who believes so much of what we think about past societies is wrong. The internationally acclaimed writer teaches at the London School of Economics and is the author of many works including Debt, The First 5,000 Years, and his latest, which I'm going to refer to as B.S. Jobs. David Graeber was recently in town, and I sat down with him for an hour to discuss human history and inequality, the influence of the native Huron leader Kondiaronk on Enlightenment thinking, and to talk about the Kurdish YPG, or People's Protection Units, fighting ISIS in Kurdish Syria while struggling for the end of patriarchy. Here's that conversation. So we learn in anthropology class that for most of human history, humans lived in tiny, egalitarian, hunter-gatherer bands, and that the original sin then took place, which was the advent of settled agriculture. People started farming. Out of that, private property, class society emerged, and then you get
cities.
And you get cities, and you get civilization, which on the one hand may allow for the flourishing of the arts, on the other hand leads to all the ills that we have lived with ever since. So that is the
The state, for example.
Exactly. Yes. And and this is the story that we get. We get it everywhere. It's a very widely established argument. What's wrong with it?
Well, pretty much everything. This story, it doesn't really come from anthropology. It really comes from the Enlightenment, people like Rousseau and even Adam Smith, you know, the sort of evolution, notion of evolutionary stages. The funny thing is that people were starting to get over it in the early part of the 20th century and realizing the story was somewhat more complicated. But somehow in the 60s, they discovered the Kalahari Bushmen and the Pygmies and become this paradigm for primordial innocence. You go back to this kind of Eden Utopia idea. But, you know, there's a worm in the bud because it's always assumed that, yes, human beings start innocent and almost like childlikely egalitarian. But the moment you get to any sort of large size, you can no longer, or you know, you can no longer maintain that. As soon as there's social complexity, as soon as you have like people, lots of people living together, having to coordinate large projects, you necessarily need hierarchy. It's functional somehow. So thus the dream is either, you know, someday we can return to being primitive again or the equivalent thereof, or maybe somehow we can get beyond. It's never clear, but the dice are so loaded. It just seems the moment we achieve complex society, we're basically doomed. Now, the problem with this is that since then, especially since the 60s, there's been enormous new research evidence. The technology of understanding, you know, analysis has gotten much better. There's been a lot more archaeology. There's been a lot better analysis of the anthropological data. And as a result, we know that pretty much every single part of that story is factually wrong. The problem is that during the period where we've been figuring that out, there's been an incredible abandonment of any public role for archaeologists and anthropologists and most scholars, to be honest. So it's not just that people don't write for the general public. They don't It's not even that they don't write for people in other fields. They don't even write for people in other subfields. So you have this incredibly specialized knowledge that nobody's putting together. And me and my friend David Wengrow is an archaeologist. This is a pet peeve of both of ours. We kind of got together and we started going through it. That, all right, if we need another grand narrative, what would it be like? What actually happened? And so, for example, the assumption that we all lived in little Kalahari Bushmen-like bands, it's not true. Even back in 1900, they knew that hunter-gatherers actually much more typically move back and forth seasonally. So they'll live in bands for maybe part of the year, but then they kind of get together. They form these little micro-cities. Often there's monumental architecture and giant feasts and ceremonies. And very often, in fact, the typical pattern is for them to have completely different social structures in different times of year. And this continues into a lot of farming societies, pastoral societies, that, you know, for example, I always like to give the example, most plains societies, indigenous societies in North America, a lot of these guys had been farmers and abandoned it and went back to hunting buffalo. And all right, those societies, for 3 months of the year, they would have something very much resembling a state. They'd have a rotating system where different warrior societies or clans would essentially have police powers, could enforce rules arbitrarily. And then during the rest of the year, the other 9 months, they'd be scattered. They'd do everything by consensus. They would have a completely egalitarian society. So how do you characterize that? You know, they're a band society one time of year and a state society or something very much like it for 3 months during the hunt and the big ritual season. Other ones would go back, like the Inuit, often would be very small patriarchal bands of private property. Then they get together and it was the opposite. When they all got together and built these little micro cities, they would have these giant wife swapping orgies and or wife and husband swapping, and they would like collective property arrangements. So they become egalitarian when they were all together and subvert all the hierarchies, and the hierarchies would be reasserted when they broke up into small groups. There's a million different patterns. So the evidence would imply that people are playing around with different social possibilities really from the very beginning. And if you look at the archaeological evidence, suddenly it makes a lot more sense, because what we found is there are these mysterious burials and sites that just don't seem to make sense. If you go back to the Ice Age, even 30,000, 40,000 years ago, you'll find these things that look like royal burials. They have incredible amounts of beads and, you know, scepters and carved ornaments of every kind, and they calculate how many thousands of hours it must have taken people to make this stuff. And there is sort of exist in magnificent isolation. There'll be suddenly this, most people weren't buried at all, but there'll be like one or two people who are buried in this incredibly magnificent way. And then it never seems to lead to anything. Or sometimes they'll have these giant monuments made of mass mammoth tusks and huge things that are clearly ceremonial. So you have these sort of princely burials, are sometimes called. You have these monumental structures, but it doesn't lead to anything like a state. You know, they exist in isolation thousands of years apart. So what do you make of this? And there's an additional really weird thing, which no one seems to know what to do with, that a majority of these magnificent burials are physically anomalous in some way. They're either hunchbacks or giants or dwarfs or things like that, you know. The best explanation we can come up with is that, you know, it's almost like playing at like social forms that had never been permanently institutionalized. These people were king for the 3 month season where everybody got together on the mammoth hunt and or whatever it might be that like allowed everyone to get together, and then people dispersed and went back to a completely different way of life.
And are you saying that these seem to be cyclical, or or is there any evidence that there was some pushback if things became too egalitarian or too?
The evidence we have is this is hard to know. But clearly, the fact that it didn't become institutionalized shows that there were structures in there to make sure that these people didn't like turn their temporary power into a way to really push people around. And there's a lot of evidence of pushback of different kinds in different times of history. One example that seems fascinating is Stonehenge. There's a bunch of things we've discovered about Stonehenge now. One I always like to point out, The chemical analysis has gotten much better. So there are these things that you always found scattered around Stonehenge and similar megalithic monuments in England. They called them vase stems. They didn't really know what they were, these little cup-like things. And finally, they managed to do trace analysis of the chemicals. They discovered their hash pipes. And also, opium was very popular at the time. So basically, the people at Stonehenge then were just as stoned as they are now. So that was
good to know. Some things don't change.
Don't change, yeah. A beer only comes later, and so you have that. But the other thing is that there does seem to have been something like dynasties and kings around Stonehenge, which seems remarkable. But it's even more remarkable when you realize that these are people who, not only were they not agricultural, they used to be agricultural and they gave it up. So there was a Neolithic revolution. Everybody said, you know, this is like way too much work. We're going to go back to gathering nuts again. So they kept the pigs and the sheep, but they got rid of all the grain crops. And so they were scattering for most of the year. So for 3 months a year, they'd come together and create these sort of magical courts, but they wouldn't last. And then they break up again.
What about cities and how we understand early cities? Because, of course, the assumption is this was the slide, depending on how you see it, towards greater civilization, or if you're of the sort of more anti-civ stripe,
right?
You know, to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah, and we're screwed and that's it. Yeah. That's what's really interesting about cities is that it seems quite likely that many, not all, but many of the first cities were actually more egalitarian than whatever had come before. And this is true in Mesopotamia. If you look at the very first period in Uruk, the first maybe 1,000 years. They used to think it was much shorter, but they realized now it's quite some time. There's no signs of the temples and palaces, and you know what it looks like when there is a hierarchy there. And none of that stuff existed for the first 1,000 years. In fact, you know, what you do have is like large meeting halls clearly designed for everyone to fit in them, things like that. The Indus Valley civilization, Harappan, again, like later, you in Indian cities, you can tell right away where the king lived and where the wealthy lived. And in these, the biggest structures were things like large public bath systems, which were clearly designed for everybody in the city. So something's very, very different. And then there's whole civilizations that we didn't even really know about, sometimes because they were, you know, in the former socialist bloc, like the Tripolia civilization, which is through Ukraine to what's now Moldova. They had cities that were actually larger than ones that existed in Mesopotamia around this very beginning. They're sometimes twice as big, but they were all arranged as circles and circles. So there's circles of houses and circles of circles. And again, there's grave goods are all the same. There's no sense. You know, there'd be one building in each of these circles that would clearly be the collective house, but it was but it's not like some magnificent person lived in them. They were clearly egalitarian cities. So there's a lot of those. And another interesting thing is that there's a tendency for cities to develop hierarchy and then change their minds. There's some of that in very early China. Some of the early cities, there's a palace and it gets burned down. But the one I always find most fascinating is Teotihuacan. You know, Teotihuacan is a place a lot of people go to nowadays. It's got these amazing giant temples of the sun and moon. Those were built in the very beginning. And there was a temples where there was mass human sacrifice. There seemed to be a clear center of government there. Something happens. It wasn't even in China. It seems to be some kind of violent revolution. They burned down the palaces. There, it wasn't even that. Something happens around 200 AD, maybe, where they bury the temple where they're doing all the human sacrifice and stop doing that. And the city is rebuilt as this, you know, over 1,000 very large, comfortable villas, all exactly the same size. And that's where everybody lives. It's like really, really nice, like housing estates, public housing. And it stays that way for 400, 500 years. And even the art in Teotihuacan, like all the figures are exactly the same size. They're trying to telegraph here as clearly as they can. But for a very long time, archaeologists, no, there must be a palace. We just haven't found it yet. You know, there had to be government. It's a giant city. It was like, you know, at least 120,000 people there, and like, you know, 400, might have been one of the largest cities in the world at the time. And it, there's no signs of a centralized monarchical or any other kind of government.
That's David Graeber, anthropologist and anarchist, and we're talking about what we know and what we don't know about the history of equality and inequality in human history. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So what do we know about the emergence of a more, let's just say, enduring class society where it doesn't seem to just sort of yo-yo back and forth.
Mm. Well, it's hard to say where these things come from, but the problem of scale is not the problem. We've been looking at exactly the opposite. I mean,
scale meaning the bigger it gets.
Yeah, the bigger it gets, the more you need top-down systems of management and control. That's been the assumption for a long time. But you know, a lot of ethnographic evidence has shown the base assumptions this is based on are just not true. Irrigation systems. I used to think once you have a complex irrigation system, you need a bureaucracy to run it. But now that we've looked at places, like Bali is a great example, where you have really, really complex irrigation systems. Actually, you know, there's thousands of water temples of local elected elders, who coordinate together. There is no central control. There are states, but they actually have nothing to do with all this all of this water administration that people assumed was what made states possible. So insofar as there are states and places with a lot of irrigation, it's largely because if you spent 20, 30 years building an irrigation system, you're less likely to run away when someone comes and tries to shake you down. You know? The states are parasitical off this stuff rather than organizing it themselves.
You had earlier said that although there's been all of this new scholarship, and some of it not so new, but over the last century, that scholars have been writing for these very, very specialized audiences and not for the public. But one person who has been writing for the public and who does make the argument of large-scale organization needing top-down rule and of a primordial innocent past that we have left and must never return to is Jared Diamond.
Yes, he is.
I wonder if you could comment on his work.
Well, I don't want to say anything too mean. Important to bear in mind that Jared Diamond is a... I believe his degree was in some medical thing, and then he became an ornithologist. But he's not actually an anthropologist, you know. What he does is he just repeats the common wisdom that we're all trained to expect. And someone actually wants to find – I don't like the word pop, you know. People say, oh, that's pop science. You know, sometimes they just mean like that science that you can actually understand. Mm-hmm. It's very elitist. But insofar as anyone's ever come up with a – reasonable definition of what is pop and what's wrong with it, it would be this, that pop theory is theory that gives you reasons you never would have thought of to believe what you already think. And that's kind of what these guys do. They come up with really clever ideas for why conventional wisdom is in fact true. And conventional wisdom isn't true. This is what Jared Diamond basically does. He gives you the same story we've been hearing for 250 years. But I'll tell you an interesting story about how we got to that conventional wisdom, which he's simply repeating, really. If you look at the Enlightenment and Enlightenment ideas, a lot of it traces back to North America and to indigenous sources. I mean, I actually think that the Enlightenment actually started in North America before the settlers actually showed up. But that's kind of a long, complicated story. One thing that I did look into in quite great detail, I looked at the French literature because it's very rich and easily accessible. There's all these Jesuit relations of, what indigenous people, what First Nations in what's now Canada thought of the settlers, the missionaries, when they first showed up. What was the indigenous critique? And it's interesting, it's quite consistent. It's the whole idea of egalitarian societies, which then is the way we now characterize them. It wasn't the way it started. Nobody talked on either side about equality, as they talked about freedom. So indigenous people were basically said, look, you guys just follow orders all the time. You're afraid of your commanders. I mean, we have chiefs. We just ignore them if we don't like what they say. They have no power to make us do anything we don't want to do. We laugh at them. You guys run around like a bunch of slaves. And they say that. And they also say you don't take care of each other. So if somebody's in trouble, nobody bails them out. You have people sleeping on the street. What the hell is wrong with you guys? You're not nice people. But in there was a similar idea, which is that, it's not inequalities of wealth that was an issue for them because, some people have a lot of, wampum or other, treasures that were things that were considered most valuable things. People would have differential amounts of that stuff. There's no way to turn wealth into power. Just because I've got more of this than you do doesn't mean I can make you do something you don't want to do. Certainly, I can't make you work for me. Now, so at first, like a lot of the First Nation people didn't understand that that wasn't the case in French society. So they were criticizing them for not being very nice. You know, here are these people who are desperate, you don't help them out, and therefore they're not able to be free, autonomous people. So you're not free in two ways. Sometimes you're poor and you can't be free. And even if you're not poor, if you're not the one guy who's in power, you're just following orders and you're afraid of somebody. So gradually, however, and it's very interesting because if you read the Jesuit accounts, you know, we're all used to this idea that, like, they're the Westerners, this is the Western gaze, they're basically us, and these indigenous people are some alien other. But in fact, it's the indigenous people are basically making the points we would make if we were there. And it's the French guys are weird, you know. So they're all, like, you know, these devout Christians, and they actually say, like, okay, these guys are the most free people who ever lived. This is a problem. We want them to become Christian. That means like 10 commandments, obedience, you know, that's like a basic principle. And they say, well, you know, the system, it doesn't seem to make any sense. They don't have any like punitive laws. They just have this system of mediation and compensation and shaming. And it says, and you know what? To be honest, it kind of works better than in France. Like there's less crime actually, but that's not the point. The point is they're supposed to follow orders. If they don't understand following orders, how are they going to like find God? So it's exactly the opposite of the usual critique of anarchism, right? They're not saying, well, it's a lovely idea, but like it would never work. They say, yeah, it works fine, but it's a terrible idea. So you know, stop that. Stop being so free. It's like bad. Okay, so it's all about freedom. But then gradually the indigenous, like... the indigenous observers, they start going to French towns. They build up Montreal. Some of them travel to New York and places like that. They get sent diplomatic missions to France. And gradually they sort of figure out, oh, I see. It's all about money and property. You guys have a system where you can take wealth and make that into a way to push people around, which just hadn't even occurred to them before. Because that potential didn't really exist in any developed sense or any sense often in their own societies. So then... okay, the key moment, there's this guy named Lahontan, Baron Lahontan, in the 1680s. He's a teenager, sort of aristocrat from an impoverished family. They lose their inheritance. He joins the army, send him to Canada. He learns Huron and Algonquian, hangs out with a lot of indigenous people, becomes friends with this guy named Kandiyohonk, who's actually, I think, one of the most important figures in the last several hundred years of intellectual history. And gradually he gets in trouble. He has to run off. He's basically a wanted man in France. He's living homeless in Amsterdam for a while, but he starts writing these books of his memoirs, which are insanely successful, ends up in the same court as Leibniz and lives happily ever after. The book that's a big bestseller is, it's called, I think, like Curious Conversations with an Interesting Savage Who Has Traveled to France. It's about Kandiyohonk, but he calls him a Dario.
And how do you spell his name?
K-A-N-D-I-A-R-O-N-K. It's usually spelled with an O, but like as people now, Iroquois speakers say, can't really be an O. Anyway, this guy is, sometimes he's just called Le Rat, the rat, because that's what the name means. He was a Huron statesman, and everybody assumed that this guy was like a sock puppet. He was some guy Lahontan made up. But a bunch of indigenous scholars have gone through the material and say, no, everybody says he was a real guy. He was the most eloquent person anybody had ever met. He was this brilliant politician who was always outwitting the French. But he also, there was this little salon where he was so good at arguing that they would invite him to the governor's house and they'd sit around to debate Christianity or debate like, you know, social organization and what's better, which are better ways. And Lahontan took notes on all this stuff. So it was these were actual conversations. And the arguments he made are exactly the same ones you find other, you know, indigenous Iroquoian speakers especially. He has a hilarious critique of Christianity. And back then, you know, the book comes out in 1704. So you couldn't actually make fun of Christianity. The only thing you could do is have somebody else do it, pretend to be arguing with them and make sure you always lose the argument. and so this is what happens. Basically, almost all the arguments, which are later to become Enlightenment sort of arguments, the anti-clerical stuff, the egalitarian stuff, it all comes from Lahontan, and thus comes from Kandirok. This book's a huge bestseller.
So you're saying that's the origin of Enlightenment thinking.
A lot of the Enlightenment radicalism. And what we now think of as egalitarian thought comes from this guy, who's like a Euron Wendat, giving like what was a really sophisticated, because he was incredibly brilliant, version of the standard Wendat critique of French people. And it turns out he had been to Paris. They sent him on a delegation to meet Louis XIV and so forth and so on. So he had a chance to observe it himself. Okay, here's where it gets interesting. So this guy, the book becomes a huge hit. Every single Enlightenment thinker writes a imitation of it. Voltaire has a half-Huron guy. Let's see, Diderot is a Polynesian. Rousseau, we all know what he does. Basically, all of these guys sort of take it up. So the idea of how you critique French society is pretend to be an indigenous person and use these same kind of arguments. It all comes to a peak with a woman named Madame Givenchy. She is one of the Salonists, and she writes a one where it's an imaginary indigenous feminist critique. It's an Inca princess who's kidnapped to France. This is 1755, like 50 years later, and making fun of French society. It's actually a feminist milestone because it's the first novel we know of with a female protagonist who doesn't either marry or die at the end. But okay, so this Inca princess is sort of making fun of French society. The book's a huge hit. Big bestseller. She has to do a second edition. So we have her correspondence. She sent around copies to her friends saying, I need to change it around a little for the second edition. What should I do? So it goes to Turgot, who's, as we know, the guy who invents the idea of progress, right? But this is like the moment we can, you know, in this correspondence, we can see it happen. He's reading this book and he's saying, I don't know. This is kind of, I don't know the political implications of this. It's kind of disturbing because, like, okay, sure, we're all for freedom and equality and in principle, but can you maintain a complex commercial society like that? Well, you know, I think you should have her realize at the end of the book that there are stages of development, evolution. And this is like where evolution is first proposed, as far as we know.
Sounding very familiar here.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and that, like, you know, when you're a hunter-gatherer or something like that, sure, you can have this. And even as a farmer like the Incas, but you know, as soon as you get up to the complex stage of modern, they didn't have industry yet, you know, modern commercial society, then you need to have a division of labor, you need to have hierarchy, and she should realize that because the payoff in terms of prosperity is you know, greater than the sacrifice and freedom and equality. And she says, yeah, like how to put that in, never mind. But so she ignores him. But the next year he gives this great speech on the idea of progress where he develops this. Adam Smith takes it up. Before you know it, you have evolution. But so the whole notion of stages of evolutionary development is actually invented as a direct response to the indigenous critique of European society, which is like incredibly popular.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm joined by anarchist anthropologist David Graeber. He's the author of a number of books, including On Kings, mm-hmm. Debt, the First 5,000 Years, and the book BS Jobs, that's the FCC compliant version of the title.
Isn't kind of guess what the title might be.
Indeed. And I'm Sasha Lilly. So to talk about political implications,
yes.
What are the political implications of imagining that for most of human history, we lived in a egalitarian way, but we were in these very small units. And then after that, you know, the original sin of settled agriculture, we lost all of that. We became these complex, larger and larger societies. The state emerged, class society emerged. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, you might say, well, but doesn't that allow us to believe that at one point, actually for the majority of our history, we lived in an egalitarian way? On the other hand, the implication may be that that is a world that is now closed to us. How do you see it?
Well, I mean, yes, the idea was we lived in an egalitarian way, but it's always followed by the assumption that since the fall, you know, since we sought after knowledge inappropriately, we're stuck, you know. Whereas if you look at this narrative that's beginning to emerge of what seems to have actually happened, and I haven't even gone into the actual origins of agriculture, which are much different than people assume, and, you know, if agriculture creates social inequality, why does it take 4,000 years for any changes to occur? you know, if you look at what really happened, what you see is that people are adults. They're not children who've not figured out inequality, and as soon as it happens to them, they're kind of stuck there. They're playing around of different possibilities. We've always been self-conscious about social possibilities. You know, if we are anything as humans, it's people have some control over the condition of our existence. We make our own worlds. And it used to be not that we were like these innocent creatures who would never let sort of open Pandora's box. It's much more a matter of we used to have more control. We used to actually be able to say, all right, we will create hierarchies for 3 months and then rip them down again. And people would literally build these monuments and then rip them down again. And somehow, so the normal state of human affairs is to move back and forth between different social possibilities, to play around. So hierarchies exist almost in play form before they exist in real form. So the question is how we got stuck in one mode. It's like we were playing this costume drama and suddenly we forgot we were playing a costume drama and here we have been ever since. Yeah, that's what happened. As Marshall Solins points out, you know, states exist in the imagination. Like, you know, people imagine these all-powerful gods who can punish you for infractions and impose codes on you. You know, in hunter-gatherer societies, we're nothing like a state apparatus at all. So people are imagining all these things. But somehow we end up stuck in one mode of, and it's a particularly awful mode.
And is it clear, is there a timeline that could be agreed on of when we got stuck?
Or is that different times and places, because sometimes we got unstuck. And that's the other thing which is important. Like, okay, this is, if you look at the story of Kandiyorank, I think the other interesting thing we learn, so they came up with this idea of evolution. We still have people say, oh, there were bands and then there were tribes and then you get chiefdoms and you get kingdoms and states. But if you look at the history of North America that produced people like that, that's not what happened at all. You know, you have like these hunter-gatherer societies which go back and forth between bands and concentrations. You have the Hopewell civilization, which is not even agricultural, where they're building these astrological giant monuments and crazy ritual centers. And then that turns into suddenly into a state, I guess, leap directly into a state. Cahokia, which seems almost like this giant empire, this huge city, bigger than anything that exists any before or after in North America, in what's now East St. Louis. So they go from hunter-gatherers to bam, you know, like this empire. Then the empire dissolves, and we don't know why. And that area where it used to be becomes like a forbidden zone on Planet of the Apes or something. Like nobody lives anywhere nearby for hundreds of years. And, okay, then you get chiefdoms coming out of that. Then those chiefdoms collapse and turn into these sort of polis-sized republics where everybody's sitting around and, you know, smoking tobacco and drinking caffeinated beverages and discussing politics, is what I'm saying. It's a sort of proto-enlightenment happening in North America before the Europeans even show up. And those are like, you know, like the Cherokee or the Osage or, you know, people like that. And sometimes they hit, you know, if you look at Cherokee myths, they're really direct. They say, yeah, once upon a time, there used to be this hereditary caste of priests, and they used to push us around and abuse women and do terrible things. So we killed them all, and now we don't have hereditary leadership. I mean, they're just like totally direct, right? And somehow people won't put two and two together. So, you know, the settlers show up, and they find these guys who are staunchly egalitarian, or like they're hippies talking about nature and being one with the world, cosmos. And it doesn't occur to them that this is, you know, maybe a political thing. You know, there used to be these, you know, all around them, there's these giant mounds of what used to be cities, like abandoned. And like here's these like guys saying, oh, no, we're against any kind of hierarchy. It never occurs to them to put two together that, you know, what you're actually seeing of guys like Kandiyorank is the egalitarian ideology that formed in reaction to and probably overthrew all of these like urban civilizations and empires and so forth. So politics exists at all times. So, you know, it's not like once we're stuck, we can't get unstuck. He got unstuck. And then, of course, you know, the settlers came and killed them all. But nonetheless, the history is full of these kind of movements and possibilities.
Which, obviously, we have a complete amnesia about now. And yeah. The implication is that there's clearly been increased concern about inequality. Mm-hmm. But the implication still is that to become egalitarian means to return to forms that are no longer possible.
Yes. And it's, I'd actually even think the word inequality is kind of loaded. Yeah. Because what does it mean? You know, I mean, what would a absolutely equal society be like?
And you write that rather than using words like class power. We
exactly.
don't hear that.
Yeah.
Inequality kind of lends itself as a term to milquetoast solutions.
Yeah, technocratic, you know, let's tinker around a little bit, adjust the Gini coefficient. I think a little too much wealth is concentrating. You know, let's distribute it a little more that way. Maybe the tax system should be skewered that way. And yeah, so it's basically about going to, like, you know, the G8 summit and readjusting and, you know, proposing ideas to, like, rejigger things rather than fundamentally change structures, because they're assumed. So obviously, we're not going to have a society where everybody's exactly the same. I mean, come on, who would want that? So, you know, and I go back to that indigenous critique, and I think one of the really interesting things about it is that they weren't talking about equality. That equality discourse only comes when they discover that you can turn wealth into power. But that's exactly what they were really objecting to. You know, instead of talking about equality, you know, what they were really saying and I think what people actually object to about what they call social inequality is not that, like, you know, you got a bigger house. I mean, maybe, okay, or maybe you'll have a bigger house and I have more books and you have, you know, well, there's things are incommensurable anyway, right? What they're objecting to is that some people can turn their wealth into power and push people around, and that other people who do not have things are considered unimportant and their perspectives and lives and needs don't matter. So that's the thing that people are objecting to, not the actual number of things people have. So if you can get – and you can't, you know, exactly adjust things so that everybody has the same, nor would you really want to. But you can get rid of a system where people can turn wealth into the ability to push the people around, and a system where anybody is told, I don't care what you want.
Is there the other side for that not very large population relative to those with sort of mainstream notions about what is possible and what is not possible, but for those people still, you know, burning the torch of the radical left?
Yes, that if like you, me.
That if we no longer imagine that so much of human history was just simply equality, not some oscillation back and forth, then how can we imagine a future that is one of equality that isn't, I don't know, market socialism or some variation back and forth between equality and inequality?
Right. I mean, I think that the word freedom has been fallen into disrepute. People don't like it. They assume that it's a bourgeois liberal concept. Of course, that's ironic since, as I was pointing out, it really, more than anything else, first of all, comes out of movements of slaves. Freedom is the opposite of slavery. And second of all, the sort of indigenous people who have the certain notion of inherent liberty and autonomy of the individual, which is then adopted, you know, in Europe, which is a society which wasn't like that at all, you know. Be this as it may, I think that our, you know, it's you can learn something from those societies. What they're essentially saying is it's not the equality that matters. It's when equality impedes on people's ability to autonomously or collectively decide for themselves how they want to live, and where it turns into an ability to basically push people around and tell people to do things they don't want to do. So I think we need to reimagine what the purpose of these economic and social arrangements are. What it is we're actually trying to achieve. There are non-liberal notions of freedom, and we need to recuperate those.
Well, and to just extend that a bit further, the implications of all of this for the present, for the future. Clearly, we live in times where what people tend to expect for the future is not particularly sunny. Obviously, global warming adds to that, but also the sense of the possible, the politically possible, given the past and the recent past. And one aspect of that, which actually global warming has a part to play in, is this notion that we might be able to live in a way that is more equal, more free, and also more sustainable. And
degrowth, for example.
Right. And so the implication is, no, it is not possible on the sort of scale that we all live in to be able to live differently. And the only way to even consider it would be a radical scaling back. It sounds like you're mounting a defense of the ability for us to live in radically free and egalitarian ways on a large scale.
Yeah, because this happened before. And you know, it's the evidence is right in front of our eyes and we just refuse to see it. You know, here you have these giant egalitarian cities that used to exist not that far away, you know. And we're just sort of saying, no, that can't be true. That didn't happen because it can't, you know, it's similar to when I talk about the BS jobs. You'll have people say, well, we have a market system, so nobody would hire someone to what isn't economically advantageous to them. So therefore, the fact that 40% of the population feels they're doing pointless jobs, they must all be wrong. Can't be happening because, you know, our basic picture of the way society works says it can't be happening, so it isn't. I don't care what empirical evidence you put in front of my eyes. It's very similar with history. We just don't see what's in front of us. There's all the negative space in the picture. You know, if you just flip it around, the picture looks really different. One thing that David Wengrow points out, he's worked on a lot of work in Egypt. Says if you, no one's quite sure how to do the numbers, but there's what they call interdynastic periods. Interdynastic periods is when they didn't actually have a pharaoh. It's like the interregnum. You assume that's like 10, 20 years, but actually no. There's like several hundred usually. And in fact, it's quite possible that there's more interdynastic periods than there are dynastic periods in ancient Egyptian history. In other words, for like at least half the time, there was no pharaoh. There was no giant monuments being built. So what were they doing then? We just ignore that. You know, why don't we write a history of Egypt in which pharaohs are the exception, and normally they're just getting on with their lives without them? So there's a lot more happening in history than we imagine. And if we go back, we discover that social possibilities are much, much richer than we would be inclined to imagine.
David Graeber is my guest. He is professor of anthropology at the London School of Economics. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So looking back at least what we can tell, what we can divine, because some of this obviously isn't always clear, about the range of possibilities and the ways that societies have shifted back and forth between varying degrees of equality and inequality. Mm-hmm. You're saying, and of course, it's fairly obvious to see that we are live in a time where that dynamic is stuck, that the oscillation. Yeah.
We're stuck in one mode.
We're stuck in one mode, and switching to the other mode seems very hard to conceive of. Are there any indications looking back about what unsticks something that's stuck, or is there anything that you would extrapolate from the past in thinking about the present?
Yeah. I mean, there's a big debate about that right now, but there's people like Scheidel. I don't know if you know him, wrote a book where he tried to argue that the only thing that's really like stopped galloping inequality has been catastrophe.
Yes.
And I don't think that's the true.
This is a writer on the right.
Yes, he's a right wing, like a Walter Scheidel. He's like one, kind of our nemesis. And on the one hand, he's written some very interesting perceptive stuff about money that I used when I was writing Debt. The other, he sort of went off the deep end, in my opinion, and came with this incredibly pessimistic approach. And I'm, on the other hand, like things that look historically like catastrophes and disasters, because we're reading a history that's written by rich and powerful people, actually, you know, probably looked really different if you were on the bottom of the social hierarchy. So look at the Dark Ages, where everything is supposed to collapse. You know, if you're talking about the Roman Empire, they have all these cities which are basically, you know, fed by slave labor. Where, you know, for every person who's like declaiming poetry and you know, Roman Damascus, there's like five guys like living their entire lives being peons in Egypt, you know, producing grain for them. And all right, so you know, in the Dark Ages, those five guys got free. You know, 40% by some estimations, probably exaggerated, but 30% of the population of Roman Italy were slaves. After the Goths, Visigoths, Vandals, and Huns came through, none of them were slaves. I mean, so it might have been disaster for the Senate who got massacred, and a lot of the, you know, sort of middle class people really suffered, but slaves did pretty well, you know. I mean, so Dark Age for whom exactly? So again, you know, something really interesting happened across Eurasia in those years of the sort of beginning of the Middle Ages, where slavery was essentially abolished in most of Eurasia. How did that happen? It's one of the great historic, must have been a social movement of some kind. From Europe, it had to have something to do with the church, but we don't know what, because almost no church father is actually against slavery. Yet somehow they reached a situation where all the slaves got freed. How did that happen? You know, things like that have happened throughout history, and even in the midst of disasters. I don't think it necessarily has to go through catastrophe and disaster, but there has to be disruption and reshuffling of the deck. Sometimes that can not be pretty, but if you look at what's going on right now, you know, we're living through some pretty non-pretty times if you happen to be in many parts of the world. Question is what will come of it. So I think that we're also living in unprecedented times because things happen faster and communications are so much quicker than they were before, that it's possible to have transformations that are coordinated across the world in ways that never happened before. I think the social possibilities for change are dramatic. What they've been doing for the last 30 or 40 years has been trying to convince us of the opposite, that somehow the rise of technology, information systems, all this incredibly rapid computer stuff has created a situation where our social possibilities are dramatically less than they were before. I always point this out to people. I had an argument with Peter Thiel about this, actually. As I pointed out,
Peter Thiel, the right-wing libertarian founder of PayPal.
Yeah. Because we were talking about technological stagnation, which is something we both agree with and think is a problem. And I actually said, okay, think about it this way. You know, for most of human history, there were 20, you know, when people were carting around wheat and ox carts, there were 27 different ways like you could organize an economy. Now we have super fast computers, and supposedly now there's just one. I thought technology was supposed to increase our social possibilities. And he was like, yeah, I guess you got a point. There probably are other ways we could organize the economy. We just haven't thought of them yet. And I, you know, if you had all the guys who were sitting around figuring out how ways to do, like, you know, really super fast trading derivatives and had said, no, come up with something other than capitalism as a way of, like, distributing goods and services, I'm sure they'd come up with 20 different alternative economies in a matter of weeks, you know, if they had all those guys with something interesting to do for a change. There's, you know, the only reason they haven't is because, you know, there's been this intense and continual effort to basically kill the human imagination, to tell us, no, forget it. Don't even think about another way. Don't even think about another system.
And some of that entails assumptions about human nature. We're told that human nature is a particular way, and that just can't be changed.
Right. But if that were true, you wouldn't have had the 37 different ways of organizing economies before this. So then they try to rewrite history and say, well, it might look like other systems, but really it was the same. For which they have to cook the books in all sorts of crazy ways. Yeah, it's a way of. I mean, it's crazy. Things that, like, are treated as inevitable that didn't even exist 20 years ago. I noticed this in the UK. Like, they got rid of free education under Blair, you know, in the 90s. And then they massively increased the tuition in 2010 to huge protest. And nowadays there's a student movement for Restore Free Education, which has been adopted by the opposition party now. And, you know, when I first propose it, the first reaction you get from hundreds of people is, how could that be possible? We could not possibly afford, where is that money going to come from to afford free education? It's like, okay, we live in England. To the north, Scotland, they still have free higher education. To the west, Ireland, they still have free education. France, Belgium, Germany, every single country anywhere around us has this, and you're saying it's inconceivable. How could you possibly say such a thing? So it's really fascinating how that brainwashing works.
Let me end by asking you about how you think that radicals can help push things in a way that we can unstick the situation that we're stuck in. Mm. I mean, the prevailing ideology, as you've described, is one of a hopelessness about any change beyond the present. The present is the best we can expect.
A cultivated hopelessness, yes.
Indeed.
Yes.
So how can we struggle against that hopelessness? And I don't mean in terms of a cheering squad, but how does one counter, how should radicals counter that ideological campaign in a way that you think might be effective, shifting things in a different direction?
We need to look at both what's happened in the past and also what's happening now. I mean, one of the things that fascinates me, and this is, I think, a symptom of this sort of collapse and abandonment of the responsibility for hope. I mean, I really think that you know, if we can't know whether a good society is possible, which we can't, as Chomsky makes this argument, I kind of agree with him on this one. You know, he says, well, why not just assume that it is if you can't know? better to like live with hope, you know. I say it's a responsibility to others to do that. You know, I mean, I'd go further. I think there is a responsibility to actually look at the possibilities for improvement and take the risk, you know. I mean, that they are possible. But if you look around, I mean, what people do is the opposite. They look around and they just can't believe that good things really are happening when they are. I mean, the example I always give is Kurdistan, is Rojava, where I just got back from another visit to Rojava a few weeks ago. And I find it...
And this is where the YPG is fighting against...
Against the remains of ISIS and now against Turkey, which basically had been the sponsor of ISIS all along. But now kind of dropped the pretense and attacked them directly.
Have embraced a radical ideology, radical politics.
Yes, the philosophy, which is largely developed, well, I mean, it's emerged from the PKK, and there's sort of movements of women within the PKK sort of challenged its old Marxist ideology, and gradually Öcalan, who's the sort of intellectual leader of the PKK, have embraced this stuff, and especially while he's been in prison, he's been reading a lot of Murray Bookchin and sort of took up the idea of social ecology, democratic confederalism, but doing a Kurdish version of that with a very, very strong, you know, emphasis not just on ecology but on women's rights. And you know, replacing the notion of proletarian revolution as women's revolution, gender has to come first. So basically when I was in Rojava, people said quite frequently, they'd said, well, you know, we're anti-capitalist, but we've learned from the 20th century that you can't get rid of capitalism without getting rid of the state, and you can't get rid of the state without getting rid of patriarchy. Well, how to get rid of patriarchy? It's going to be a long and complicated process, but making sure all women have access to automatic weapons, that's a start, you know. So, you know, all those images you see of women with machine guns, that's not a coincidence. That's also not just like, oh, they're desperate, they'll arm anybody. No, it's very, very self-conscious feminist ideology going on there. And the fascinating thing to me is why... You know, aren't revolutionaries all over the world saying, oh, my God, it's, you know, Spain 1937-6 all over again. You know, I mean, some are, right? But the reaction on the part of, like, probably majority at first of leftist organizations is this can't be real. They're faking it. They're pretending to be, like, libertarian communists and eco-feminists, you know, just to get our attention. Which is, of course, first of all, deeply racist. But even aside from that, I mean, it's like the most narcissistic, absurd position I've ever heard. It's like, that's right. They're a bunch of Stalinists, is the line. But in order to get, like, you know, Western left support, they're pretending to be anarchists. Like, sure, if I wanted to fake an ideology to get international support, I'd choose anarchism. That's going to happen. They're not total idiots. You know, if you're going to fake an ideology, you're going to pretend to either be a liberal or an Islamist. Those guys have guns. They have tanks and planes they'll give you. It's absurd. Yeah. But it shows something about the sort of defeatism that people just can't believe it's really happening.
Well, let me... Leave it right there. David Graeber, it's been a great pleasure to talk to you today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be allowed to come here and rant with you.
David Graeber is an anarchist anthropologist, author of many books. Mm-hmm. He teaches at the London School of Economics, and his books include The Utopia of Rules, On Kings, and his latest is B.S. Jobs. If you Google it, you'll find the full name. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.